For many years now, our congregation has had an opportunity to support the Dillon family in many ways. But one of the nice things about God's work is it evolves and changes. And so today I'm going to invite Joy to come up and share a bit about her coming work and her new role with OMF. And later this morning we'll hear Samuel share from his recent trip to Egypt. Joy?
Well, hello, everybody. Lovely to see all of you. I thought about, as I was coming to share about what I'm doing, I realized I have completely the wrong thing to say, because I'm going to share about what we are doing, because you guys are part of the ministry that I happen to be the front person doing it, but your prayers, your giving, your love, and your support of me is what enables us together to be doing the work that I'm doing right now. So let's think about what we are doing. Let's share about what we are doing. You may not know what you're doing, so I'm here to tell you what you're doing. And I just wanted to start by sharing what you will be doing in the next 3 weeks. So you will be flying out to the Philippines with me this evening. We're going to the Philippines for 4 days. The Philippines is a very interesting country because it's a country, I work for OMF, it's a missionary agency that focuses on East Asia, and we used to have a lot of missionaries in the Philippines. Actually, we have very few missionaries in the Philippines today because there is such a strong church there doing the work of the gospel amongst their own people, as well as sending missionaries and missional workers across the world. But we do still have a small team there in the Philippines, and they've invited me to come. They have a new center leader and a new leadership team, and they've asked that I would come and, with one of my other colleagues, do a team launch and a team build for them. So we will be investing in this leadership team as they have the vision to stand alongside the believers in the Philippines and encourage and strengthen the work that the Philippine church is doing, and as they also are going out in mission to other nations. So we'll be doing that for a few days, and then we're going to hop over to Singapore for a week. One of my jobs in OMF is that I serve on our international leadership team, and one of the jobs within that we have been given is to set up a week-long meeting for all of the senior leaders within OMF. So that's about 38 different centers. The leaders of those centers will all be gathering in Singapore. And this is really significant. It's the first time we're actually gathering all of our leaders in this particular way. And that our focus for this week is connect. How to bring, we're like a federation, we're like different states. Every center is a little different, doing their own things, but we work with together as a fellowship. And so how do we really work more deeply together? How do we really encourage that collaborative spirit amongst the different centers as we focus on what God is doing amongst East Asia's peoples and how we work to see God's kingdom come, to see mission movements come out of East Asia to the blessing of the world? And so it's a really significant week. And one of my colleagues and I are leading that week. We've set up everything, and I'm facilitating a lot, which I am very, very nervous about. These are very mature, seasoned leaders, and the feeling of who am I to be stand? Who are we? Maybe you guys could do it. Maybe you need to come with me in actual fact, not just in prayer and support. But so be praying for that week. One of our heart's desires for that week is that we will really encounter God together. That people are tired, weary, it's a tough life out there, it's tough to lead in this environment. And that as our leaders come together, that we would really be able to encounter God and receive a fresh encouragement from the Holy Spirit to continue in the work that he has given us. So be praying, please. So that's not next week, it's the following week that we will be gathered in Singapore. Then I head home. I'm home for about 2 days, and then I head off to Los Angeles, where I will be leading a training for our U.S. team, something we call Daniel Learning, which is really about understanding culture and cultural humility. So be working with our home side here in the U.S., and I will be leading a training for about 20 people here in our U.S. home site. We will be doing that together. So I hope you're ready for some action and some excitement. So be praying for those different events that are coming up. And again, this is what we are doing together. Some of the other things we're doing together, besides my normal job, which is overseeing several centers, working on the international leadership team. David, would you stand up and do a little twirl for me? We are creating a Hudson Taylor movie, and I am now overseeing the making of a movie. Whoa! Ah, amazing! I'm learning a lot about the movie industry. I got given this role, and here I am. And so that's something we're hoping to start shooting in January of next year. And I'm very excited about that. And I'm also being given a new role overseeing all of the training and leadership development within OMF. So I've added that to my portfolio of things that I'm doing. And I'm also overseeing the founding of a new OMF sending center out of Brazil. So I keep quite busy. We keep quite busy, friends, with all the things that we together are accomplishing for God's kingdom. I really do see myself just as I happen to be the one at the front doing it, but really together we are seeking to see God's kingdom move forward with grace, mercy, kindness, and justice in places. And I truly believe one of the greatest injustices in the world is the unequal access to the gospel. And that part of what we get to do is to bring equal access to the gospel, particularly in unreached people groups in East Asia. And that's my passion. That's why I do all these things that I do, is because I want everybody to have access to the beautiful hope that we have in Jesus. So thank you for your prayers. Thank you for your commitment to us as a family, to the ministry that I'm a part of. And actually, I was supposed to be preaching today, but I said, why don't we give Samuel a chance to preach? So thanks for giving me a break. I don't have to preach, but I'm really excited. I'm excited to hear from Samuel today, and I'm sure that you will be blessed by his.
Okay, can everybody hear me okay? Yeah? Yeah? Okay, good. All right, good morning, everybody. That's not good. Is it in the clock? Okay, well, you'll have to forget. I've actually, oh, no. Dad, never mind. It's double-sided. okay, we're okay. I'm very privileged to be here. I've never actually preached before. As you might tell, I'm a little nervous. Hopefully I make sense. Sometimes I talk really fast, so if I am, feel free to yell at me and say slow down. I will take that. But yeah, I feel really privileged and honored to be talking to you guys today. As a church, you guys have been longtime supporters of my family, and I feel really appreciative that so many of you gave to help me get to Egypt and were willing to talk with me and ask me questions of how was it and how are you doing preparing, and to give me books. So, like, here's, I don't know, a good book that maybe you want to read before you go. And I think, yeah, I just felt really deeply honored by that. So I just really wanted to start by saying thank you. You guys are amazing. And I genuinely mean that. Thank you very, very much. Okay, yeah. When I first said yes to going on Trek, which is this program that I went to Egypt for 6 weeks, I actually didn't really know very much about Sudan. I'd like read a book maybe in middle school. I knew that there was like a lot of conflict there, that there was a civil war. I knew that it wasn't really like talked about very much in American media. It's maybe a conflict that we don't talk enough about. Since going, I've learned a lot about the facts. So in 2023, a new civil war broke out in Sudan. And since in the past 2 years, 1 in 3 people in Sudan in the pre-war population have been displaced within their country. 1 in 3. Millions of folks have had to flee across the border into neighboring countries. And Egypt is actually the largest receiver of Sudanese refugees. Refugees come to Egypt because there's a UNHCR office. That's the department of the UN that's supposed to take care of refugees. And they hope that even though Egypt doesn't take permanent resettlement, so if you're from Sudan and you go to Egypt, you can't live there forever. But Egypt is willing to hold these people as they apply to become refugees in countries across the world and go through that process. The UN office is really underfunded. Like maybe $100 million underfunded. There is a huge need. So refugees, when they first arrive, they get sent a text and they go to the UN office, right? And they get this text. They maybe wait 9 months for just their first appointment with the office to even say that they are allowed to be here and that they're a refugee. So for 9 months, you're living in a different country and you don't have anything other than a text saying, oh, I'm here because I'm a refugee. Many folks have waited a decade, 2 decades for permanent resettlement. They're still waiting. As a country right now, we're not taking refugees from Sudan under this current administration. So if you got assigned America by the UN, that just means you have to wait. So the UN gives you a country, and once they do, that doesn't change. So it's a pretty huge crisis. And so what me and my team did, there were maybe like 5 of us, is we went and we lived in a slum community in the outskirts of Cairo. Cairo is this huge city. They just keep on expanding it into the desert. And there's a lot of different, like, slum, that has like a lot of different, I don't know what comes into your head, so I want to like clarify that. I'm actually using the UN's definition, which requires that it's missing a basic need. It's a community, it's a set of households that are missing a basic need. So that could be access to improved water, that could be there's too many people living in too cramped of spaces. That's actually the case in the slum community that I was living in. There's a huge demand for housing in Cairo, and as more and more refugees have poured in, as the local Egyptian population has grown bigger, rent prices keep on going up. And so there's a lot of actually racial tension. The Egyptians blame the Sudanese for causing rent prices to go up. They say more and more Sudanese come in, and the rent just keeps on getting more and more expensive, and we wish they would all just go home and stop taking up space in our city. Most folks in the slums are renting, and most of the landlords are Egyptian, and they can be pretty discriminatory in how they treat Sudanese refugees. So I was teaching at a community center, and I was teaching English there. And the center had just moved into a new space, and they'd lived there for about a month when the landlord decides that he wants to sell it. So they had signed a year-long contract saying, we're going to keep this place for a year. 1 month into their year-long contract, the landlord is bringing in people to tour the house as classes are being taught. Halfway through our project, the center was asked to leave and to pack up everything. So I actually helped them move and pack up everything and to find this temporary location in a Sudanese like elementary school. So they were forced out. And the moment that, right, the landlord's like, okay, you have to leave now. And we pack everything up. And then we're like, where's the security deposit? The landlord goes and he runs off to Alexandria, the other biggest city in Egypt, and he doesn't pick up his phone. So it's this like huge mess trying to chase down this guy to even get the security deposit back. So many folks are living with family or have been kicked out just because of the housing situation. So I want to tell a couple of stories about some people. I changed their names. But these are real people. So I was teaching English, and that was something that I did. I taught English at a local elementary school to little Sudanese kids, and they were super cute. And we did like head, shoulders, knees and toes, and then we'd sing it faster and faster, and then we'd sing it backwards. And we'd play like games like nose, toes, 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 nose, toes, 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 and you'd have to like call it back. They loved that one. And then I was teaching adult classes in the evenings to more grown-up people who wanted to learn English so that when they eventually get repatriated, when they are resettled, that they'll have the language skills in order to do well. But many refugees, they not only speak English, they speak Spanish, they speak German, they speak French. They're trying to learn whatever language that they hope that if they get placed in that country, that they'll at least have the language skills. It's one of the only things you can really do to prepare while you're waiting, is just to keep on learning languages. But besides teaching classes, really what I got to do is I got to hear folks' stories. So I want to tell you about Jamel. Jamel's from Darfur. He and his family moved to Cairo when his sister got really sick. There wasn't enough advanced medical treatment. There wasn't any hospitals to take care of her in Darfur. So they came to Cairo, and as a family, they all worked really, you know, everybody's together. They're trying to pool their money in order to take care of this sister of his who's really sick, and she dies anyway. And now they're in Cairo, and they decide it's too dangerous to go back, so we're just going to stay here. So he's been here since 2015. A week before I met him, he was stopped on the street by an Egyptian in plain clothes, and the Egyptian had him empty out all of his pockets and look through all of his stuff. Jamel felt too scared to say no. He didn't know who this person was. Was he a member of the Egyptian secret police, dressed in plain clothes? Was he a member of a gang with a knife? So he consented to the search, and when this Egyptian found out that Jamel didn't really have any money, he was like, "Where are your dollars? All you Sudanese people, you always have dollars hidden somewhere." And he was like, "I'm going to go search your house." And Jamel was like, had to keep on being like, "I have no dollars. I have nothing, right? I live with my sister. I've been kicked out of my own house. I have no dollars. I barely have any money. I don't know what you're looking for, but I don't have it." And that's the reality that these people are facing. I want to tell you about a different friend of mine, Ibrahim. He's an orphan. He's about my age. His parents died of cancer. Again, they came to Egypt looking for medical treatment. He was taken in by a family that kind of helps run the center that I was teaching at. So they've taken in a couple of kids and just kind of loved on them and given them a place, especially orphans, and kind of just like permanently have added them into their family. He really wants to be a pro soccer player or a musician. He hopes that he'll go join Real Barcelona. I learned so much about soccer. Sudanese folks love playing soccer. I'm not very good, but they would always try and get me to play with them. But for Ibrahim, he finds it really hard to find friends his age. Growing up, he had a lot of friends growing up in Cairo, but most of them have joined local gangs. So the Egyptian police, they don't investigate crimes committed against Sudanese. So what has happened is there's high unemployment, right? So the Egyptians don't like the higher Sudanese folks. And so then in order to make money, you join a gang and you rob other Sudanese. So these are Sudanese people robbing Sudanese people. And it's a huge issue. I met people with scars on them. Yeah, I was stabbed with a knife on the streets. There's streets that it's like, I was always walking at night. I would always have like a Sudanese person and they'd be like, "Let's go a different way. I don't like the feel of the street. I know this street. We can't go this street." So for Ibrahim, he doesn't really trust any of his friends. He's really lonely. He really wanted to. He almost did this. There's gold mines on the border between Sudan and Egypt. And for a lot of young Sudanese men, it can feel like a way out. Because either, you know, if you could get lucky, you could get really rich. There's always stories of people who have gone off to these gold mines in Upper Egypt and gotten really rich. The problem is, people know that you can get really rich. And so there's huge gang warfare. So folks from Sudan will come across the border in big groups with guns, and they will kind of patrol this entire region looking for anybody who might be carrying gold. And so the only reason, he almost went. He was this close. I was like praying for him. I was like, dude, don't go. The only reason he didn't went was because his friends who was there got stuck there. He's like, I can't climb down the mountain because right now the valleys, they're just shooting constantly, 24/7. And so he was like stuck up there. And when I left, we didn't know if he was going to make it down. I still don't really know what happened to this friend of his. But there's a desperation. There's a desperation of, we just need to get out of here because things are so terrible here for us. Lots of refugees try to, they talk about going off to Libya and taking a boat across the Mediterranean, and then trying to sneak through Europe into a country like Germany or Italy or the UK, because once you're in, it's really hard to be kicked out. But as you probably have all heard about boats in the Mediterranean carrying refugees, those are super dangerous. But it's something that folks talk about, of things feel so bad here, that why not give it a try? Things can't get any worse. So, you know, they like to say, Allah willing, God willing, inshallah, I will make it across and my life will become better. But if I don't make it across, I haven't really lost anything because I don't really know where my life is going. So this is a lot. This is really intense. And I want to acknowledge that. And when I look at all of this, I struggle to see the God who the Bible talks about. God claims in books like Isaiah or Luke that he came for the poor, that he came for the marginalized, that he came for the widowed, the orphaned, the exiled, the foreigner. Yet God can feel the most far away from the greatest conflicts and needs in the world. God feels absent. When Jesus came and he was doing ministry on the world, in the world, when he came down, right? There was this kingdom thing that he kept on talking about. He would say things like, the kingdom of God is like a mustard seed, the smallest of all seeds, yet when it grows up, it becomes a tree for all the birds. I feel like God is saying, right, I want to create a kingdom where everybody has a home, right? This mustard seed that grows up into a tree and all the birds can live there. Jesus, it's been 2,000 years, and I don't know if I see this tree anywhere. How long is this tree going to take? Is this tree really here? Or look at Psalm 84. Even the sparrow has found a home, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may have her young, a place near your altar, Lord Almighty, my King and my God. God, did you maybe forget about the millions of Sudanese who were in the future when you wrote that? Because it's great that the birds get a home, but what about these refugees? And Jesus, when you said, look at the birds of the air, they do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. And how much more valuable? Are you not much more valuable than they? Who were you talking about in this day? Did this maybe not apply to the Sudanese refugees? Because it doesn't seem like, it seems like the birds are getting fed, but the Sudanese living in Sudan aren't getting fed. Are they really more valuable to you? In my worst moments, I feel really lost. God, are you really a loving Father? Do you really have a plan? Where are you, God? In moments like this, I find the greatest comfort in turning to Psalm 131, which will be the heart of what we're talking about today. The psalm goes like this. O Lord, my heart is not lifted up. My eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. But I have calmed and quieted my soul, like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child is my soul within me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forevermore. It's a short psalm. It's written by David. And we don't really know exactly when David wrote this. Commentators debate. But one of the possibilities that I've landed on while reading different people's thoughts on it is that David was writing this as he was in exile running away from Saul. Saul was chasing him, and David was living in the caves. David had gotten this huge promise from God. God had sent the prophet of the time, Samuel, to go and to anoint him, and basically had promised, you're going to be the next king. We don't know how long David spent in the wilderness. Again, commentators disagree. Probably some time more than 7 years. I could just imagine what it would have been like to have been one of David's men. You know, you're like, are you going to talk to him? Am I going to talk to him? Okay, well, I guess I'll talk to him. Hey, David. It's really great that God promised you this 7 years ago. It's really great that, like, Samuel anointed you to be the king. But are you sure this is right? It's been 7 years. If God really wanted you to be king, he could have, like, struck Saul dead by now with, like, a lightning bolt. He could have made his will a little bit more clear. Like, what is God doing? This feels, like, really cruel and confusing. It's been 7 years. This is, you know, are we expected to wait another 7 years? Are you going to be, like, king for a year and then be dead? Like, I mean, come on now. Like, we're all getting old. I feel like that's a pretty reasonable argument to make. But in this psalm, David doesn't seem to see it that way. The first few lines, O Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high, I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. My heart is, my eyes are, I do not. These are describing things that David is already true for him. He's not like, oh, I'm trying to like not raise my eyes too high. David is saying, my eyes are not raised too high. David is saying, my heart is not lifted up, right? His heart is humble. In the midst of everything that is going wrong, in the midst of I don't know where God is, he's in a posture of submission and humility to God. I'm not there. I'm going to be so honest with you. I'm like, dude, I need to get on David's level. Something that David believes about God that I'm not getting, something that David believes about God is prompting this in him. In the midst of everything else, he has this faith. And I'm like, wow, like, what is your secret, David? How can you have faith in the midst of all of this? When I read this, I'm like, this is like the aim. Like, I try to be like, okay, yeah, like, I shouldn't raise my eyes too high, but I can't say, oh, my eyes are not raised too high. If I was to write a psalm, it would probably go something like, dear God, pretty worried about the state of the world. A lot of things seem to be going wrong. Please come back soon. Signed, your concerned servant Samuel. P.S., if you can't come back soon, maybe you could do like something really, really big that solves everything. Just a suggestion. Signed, Samuel again. But David doesn't write a psalm like this. Instead, if we keep going, I think we see the heart and the secret of why he has this posture. He says, but I have calmed and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child is my soul. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forevermore. I think this has the secret that David is carrying. It's talking about this quieted soul. It's talking about this weaned child. There's a lot to unpack in this. So I kind of had to look this one up. What is a weaned child? For people who don't know, that's like a child who's not breastfeeding anymore as its main way of getting nourishment. So that's the opposite of a nursing child, is a child who's breastfeeding. Yeah. Yes. Okay, just making sure that's right. Science is not really my area of expertise. In this line, but I calmed and quieted my soul. When we think of this word soul, we have this like idea we got from the Greeks, basically, that it's like something like on a different spiritual world that like lives inside of me, and when I die, it like leaves my body, but somehow it's like helping keep me alive. To David, to the ancient Hebrew writers, that idea would have been like crazy. To them, right, they would have looked at Genesis and they would have saw how did God animate humanity? He breathed life into them. So the soul is actually really connected to the throat. So I think a better interpretation of this is actually throat. Right? It's the thing that shows that you, as long as air is going through your throat, you're still alive. right? It's the animating force. It's how God is breathing into you in every single moment. And when God stops breathing into you, you die. So if we read it again in that context, but I've calmed and quieted my throat instead of my soul, like a weaned child is my throat, right? I feel like there's like this rich depth to it that like totally changes this a little bit, at least for me. Because I'm told that like nursing children cry a lot when they're hungry and that they're pretty demanding. I've never had a child or like really seen one for long enough to really know if that's true, but this is what I'm told. Right? That's how they get what they want, is they just keep on crying, and eventually they get their way. And that's how they communicate with their mother. I'm going to cry until my needs are met. I'm going to be really loud until my needs are met. Weaned children, I'm told, are a little bit more different. They're older, and they're not reliant on their mother's breast milk anymore. But I think they're also a little bit more patient. I think a weaned child would be able to say, I'm kind of hungry right now, but I know my mom. I know who she is. I know what she's like. She's kept me alive for this long. She's going to feed me, right? So I can like sit a little bit with the discomfort. If I get too hungry, I'll probably start crying or complaining or be like, when's dinner? But I'm willing just to appreciate my mother's presence. I'm willing to trust, even when I don't understand. I have no idea why I'm not getting food right now. I have no idea when food is coming. I don't really understand the world. I'm a child. I'm a baby. But I'm trusting that I'm going to get fed. And I'm sitting with this tension inside of me of things are not right. Things are not okay. But it's going to be okay soon. Because I know who I'm in a relationship with. I know what that person is like. And because of that trust that I'm having in that person, even though none of it makes any sense, I am acting on faith. I'm saying, you have shown up before, you will show up again. I think that is like God. I have to believe, even though it doesn't make any sense up here, even though like this is not what college teaches me, that God is going to show through, that God is going to pull up, that he can't have abandoned Sudan, Egypt, Cambodia, anywhere. That if I can't see it, that maybe I just have to be patient. And I love in this psalm too, by the way, there's no explanation for like, oh, but it's okay because he doesn't even try to explain this, what am I trying to say here? Like God's timing. He doesn't try to explain God's timing. David isn't like, oh, it's okay. I understand why God had me wait for 7 years. I understand why I had to wait this long, why he promised this, but then there was a delay. There's no talk about the timing at all in this psalm. Instead, there's just a talk about trust. I'm just trusting, and that's the only posture I can have. And I have to believe that God is looking at the world with eyes that can see further than I can. That when God looks at a crisis like Sudan, he's seeing 1,000 years from now, and he's saying, I am going to restore this, and that what you're doing right now, Samuel, it's not enough. What anybody is doing to help solve this crisis isn't enough, but that I am enough. I am the God who can turn loaves and fishes and multiply them. I'm the God who can turn water into wine. I am working. I am moving. And there is a future that we are coming for that is coming too slow, that we are yearning for, where situations like Sudan, where communities like the refugee population living probably 1,000 years from now all across the world, it is going to be better. They are going to get justice. Justice is going to be happening. And can I wait? Can I sit with the dissonance? Can I be okay with the fact that this isn't going to happen maybe in my lifetime? This isn't going to happen as fast as I want it to be, in the way that I want it to be, and I will probably never understand on this earth why it's taking so long. But can I be okay with that? And I think that's what I'm sitting with. Can I be okay with how God is moving? Can I really submit everything about what I believe and say, I don't understand it with anything that I'm using up here, but I still choose to trust God? And I think that's what I've taken away from this summer. That's the big question that I've been wrestling through, will probably wrestle through another good couple, 5 decades or so until I go up to heaven. Hopefully more than that. Yeah, I don't really know how to end this. but I would hope the same for you guys here. I think a lot of you are a lot wiser than me already and probably have wrestled through a lot of these questions. But to truly believe that what you guys are doing here, and I believe this, is transforming Eugene, is transforming Springfield, is transforming the world in ways that we might not see the fruit of right now, that I might not see the fruit of, but that is in alignment with what the world that God is trying to bring forth. Thank you very much.